Hello, welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Hassan. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, a class action lawsuit has been greenlighted by BC Supreme Court. Claimants seeking damages after 35,000 liters of fuel spilled in Lemon Creek in the Slocan Valley.
Once and for all, the highest court in British Columbia has said this matter can now go to trial as a class action on behalf of all these individuals who were affected by the evacuation order to determine who was at fault.
Writer, activist, and journalist Desmond Cole speaks at Mount Allison University about how schools handle equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility.
Sometimes I worry that these words are a smokescreen, is a way of avoiding actually doing some really simple, basic things that students are asking us to do.
Back to British Columbia, where 75,000 hectares of rainforests have been turned into a conservancy. The Supreme Court of Canada ruled in 1988 that Canada's criminal code provisions related to abortion were illegal. 35 years later, Canada is still one of the few countries in the world where abortion is 100% legal.
I don't think Canadians recognize just how exceptional and important that is to equity and to our democracy.
Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Welcome, happy to have you with us. A class action lawsuit got the green light from BC's Supreme Court following the Lemon Creek fuel spill in the Slocan Valley. On January 26, 2013, a tanker truck slid down a ditch and spilled some 35,000 liters of fuel into the water stream, which leads down to the Slocan and Kootenay Rivers. The incident prompted the evacuation of more than 2,000 residents. Vancouver-based lawyer David Rosenberg has been fighting the case for the past 9 years. In Nelson, BC, John Roon spoke with him about the Lemon Creek oil spill and the legal implications of the class action lawsuit.
On the afternoon of Friday, July 26, 2013, Baker Street in Nelson was busy with hundreds of visitors and the mood was on top for Market Fest. But while music and street food was in the air downtown, some people in the Slocan Valley began smelling gasoline, and they would soon find out why. A tanker truck from Calgary-based Executive Flight Center was heading to fuel up local rescue helicopters fighting a nearby wildfire, but the driver had gotten lost searching for the refueling station and taken a dangerous path, a closed road that was poorly maintained and was carved out of a hillside, not suited for heavy traffic. Something went wrong that led the tanker to tip over and slide down the ditch, sending gallon after gallon of A1 jet fuel out into the water stream, forming an oil slick that would travel downstream to the Slocan River. That same night, an evacuation order was issued for residents in up to a 35-kilometer stretch around the spill, as hazard crews were rushed from Vancouver to begin the over $5 million cleanup job. Over 2,500 people were evacuated that day, and more than 500 locals took shelter in three nearby emergency centers set up in area schools. Now, the effects of the spill began showing in the residents too, as some began complaining of headaches and nausea from the heavy smell as the slick of fuel continued its path downstream. Kids swimming in the river near Appledale, just north of Winlaw, were later reported to have gotten skin rashes, and canoers in the area also reported feeling sick. In the years that followed, the criminal proceedings would find that the spill had caused great harm to the environment and wildlife in that area, and both the driver and the company he worked for were found guilty under the Environmental Management Act. But that left the question of who was responsible for those who were affected and suffered health effects, had to spend money on hotels, and those who ended up losing money from contaminated crops or had to cut off water supply for their livestock during the spill. Now that you know the backstory to this legal case, meet this guy, David Rosenberg.
Oh, hi, John. How are you?
He is a lawyer in Vancouver and has been working on this case for 9 years. Get that. And now he's heading to the BC Superior Court to bring forward a class action lawsuit for those who were affected by the spill. I spoke with him right before the weekend, just a couple of days after he learned that the class action lawsuit for compensation for the people affected had been certified, which means that it got the green light to be dealt with after the defendants in the case kept appealing. So first of all, we'll hear from David Rosenberg on some of the background.
I'm representing the representative plaintiff in a class action lawsuit. The representative plaintiff is named Robert George Kirk. He now represents a group of people who were residents or tenants or people who were present at an area that was evacuated as a result of a fuel spill in 2013. And as a result of the fuel spill, there was everyone who was ordered evacuated, which encompasses about 2,776 properties, are members of this class. Their case will now go to court. As a result of this truck going off the road and dumping its fuel into the river, there was an evacuation ordered. And after the evacuation, we went to court on behalf of all the people who were affected to see if we could help them bring an action seeking both compensation for their loss of use and enjoyment of their property, but also their out-of-pocket expenses, and even the diminution of their property value. After fighting this for 9 years, the courts have now given us the green light to say, okay, once and for all, the highest court in British Columbia has said this matter can now go to trial as a class action on behalf of all these individuals who were affected by the evacuation order to determine who was at fault for this terrible spill, and perhaps to even determine how much people will get for their loss of use and enjoyment of their property as a result of the spill.
Now the question is how the complainants will be compensated, and that in and of itself is apparently a major process to be determined by the court, better explained by David Rosenberg.
Those who have suffered, who have claims that are greater than the average, they will have a right to come forward and prove their individual damages over and above that average amount or aggregate amount. The driver of a truck went down a road that was closed and basically went by signs that said, this road is closed, do not enter. And the road was not properly maintained. So the question is whether or not the province has ultimate responsibility here for what occurred, but a criminal court has already found that Danny Lasante, the driver, was guilty of offenses under the Fisheries Act, and also found that Executive Flight Center Fuel Services Limited is guilty. I can put it this way, if you don't mind, John, it's up to the court to decide which of the defendants are at fault and what their proportionate liability is. So they may all be at fault.
So things are now rolling on to the court, but it begs the question about how Rosenberg, who will now be soon up against the province, the fuel company, and the driver, what he feels about the court finally granting them the opportunity to litigate.
These thousands of people who've been waiting 9 years without justice haven't had access to justice. I mean, I've been a lawyer for 43 years and done many class actions, and I've never seen a case where it's been certified as a class action, then appealed and decertified, then gone back to court and been recertified, and then that's been appealed, and finally our highest court, the Court of Appeal, says, no, this certification is going to be upheld, and it's going to go ahead and go to trial. And personally speaking, I was greatly relieved at getting the green light to finally go ahead on behalf of all these people who haven't had justice.
That's class action lawyer, Vancouver-based David Rosenberg, who will be heading to court probably sometime this year to advocate for the class who were affected by the 2013 Lemon Creek oil spill in the Slocan Valley. And we have reached out to Executive Flight Services for comment, but they declined. I'm John Roon.
Hello, I'm Andrew Dow in Six Nations, Ontario. You are tuned in to Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca.
And we stay in British Columbia, where 58,000 hectares of rainforest in the Incomplew River headwaters have been turned into a conservancy. The river is located southeast of Revelstoke and flows south into the beaten arm of Arrow Lake. Along with the conservancy, 17,000 hectares of forest in the lower end of the river valley will also be protected from forestry activity. With this decision, the BC government recognizes the significance of the inland and temperate rainforest. The Nature Conservancy of Canada worked with the federal and provincial governments to create this conservancy. This means that there can be low-impact use in the area, but commercial logging, mining, and hydropower generation other than local run-of-the-river projects aren't allowed. Interfor, one of the largest lumber producers in the world, based out of Vancouver, owned the harvesting tenures of four parts of the interior rainforests in question. The Nature Conservancy of Canada bought the tenures from Interfor to create a protected area. Richard Klafke is the program director for the NCC for the Canadian Rockies program area. He's with Megan Dooling.
Well, so the Incomplew River Valley is about 30 kilometers southeast of Revelstoke. For many years, there's been conservation groups focused on the old growth features of the inland temperate rainforest, which is a unique ecosystem sort of from the Northern Rockies down to the border. And there's massive ancient rainforest in there in some small patches of intact ecosystems. The rivers has bull trout and kokanee. There's rare mosses and lichens that previous researchers have identified. And it's just, really complements the Glacier National Park and the sort of the wilderness coming out of that valley that leads all the way down into the tributary of the Columbia River in the watershed there.
Has this area ever been logged before?
The lower parts of the valley have been logged in the past. It was part of a tree farm license, and NCC had worked with Interfor to identify to be able to buy out a portion of their tree farm license. And so that paved the way for the province to engage with local First Nations and create this 75,000 hectare conserved area.
Now that this is being announced as a conservancy area, what will be the future? Will it become a provincial park or something like this?
So a BC Parks Conservancy, it protects lands for the biological diversity in this natural environment, for all the social, cultural, and ceremonial uses of First Nations. And so there can be low impact, compatible recreation, and even economic uses there. Things like commercial logging, mining, and power wouldn't be allowed in there, but the main priority will be for the biodiversity ecosystems and protecting those so that that would be around for the future for all people.
And you mentioned that you bought tenures, the Nature Conservancy of Canada bought tenures from Interfor, a forestry company. Were the negotiations to get to that point, how were those? Was it pretty straightforward, or was it a lot of work to come to the agreement with the forestry company?
Well, it was pretty straightforward. They identified an area that they thought would be ideal for something similar for a conservancy going forward. So it showed that there was a good example of what people can do when you work together. And it's the kind of collaboration, solution oriented projects that inspire other private sector companies maybe to get involved. So that they can, invest in nature. And this is our moment of, a good once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get it right and protect that valley. The headwaters are still fairly intact. It's a rare, precious area that has been identified before that it's now finally be conserved as a BC Park Conservancy.
And what First Nations have you been working with?
So several First Nations whose territory includes the Incomplew Valley have been involved, but mostly in consultation with the province. So we are pleased that the province has committed to actively engage with them on the development of a collaborative management framework for the Incomplew Valley. Any nation that identified as the Incomplew being in their traditional territory have been involved in working with the province on a future management framework for the area.
Richard Klafke is with the Nature Conservancy of Canada. I spoke with him over the phone from Invermere. I'm Megan Dooling.
Sarah Gouda in Halifax, Nova Scotia. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Writer, activist, and journalist Desmond Cole was recently invited to Mount Allison University to talk about how schools handle equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility. Equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility, or EDIA for short, has become a standard acronym and feature of policymaking in institutions like Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick. But what EDIA means and what it accomplishes in terms of the needs of the people on the ground at those institutions are questions that Desmond Cold recently spoke about at that university's President Speaker Series conference. Cole is based in Toronto. His work focuses on anti-racism and the struggle against state violence. His 2020 book, The Skin We're In, A Year of Black Resistance and Power, won the Toronto Book Award and the OLA Evergreen Award. Erica Butler spoke with Desmond Cole.
I'm really interested in the fact that a lot of universities and colleges are really adopting and putting forward this language of equity, diversity, inclusion, and in the case of Mount Allison, A for accessibility, EDIA. Some schools say EDID, and their second D is decolonization. Now, schools are using a lot of this like heavy language to talk about what they like to accomplish on campus. My concern is that when I talk to students, which I do all the time, most of them don't describe what they need for school in this language. It's actually a lot more simple than that. I mean, we know that a lot of students struggle just to get by. Basic things. A lot of students deal with things like issues of feeling safe on campus, issues with campus security or police. But what we're getting is this really lofty language around EDIA that for me sometimes doesn't seem to be connecting with what students actually say that they need or want. A lot of this EDIA stuff isn't really about students. It's about hiring a couple of people in, you know, administration at the school and saying, well, we're doing something because we have an EDIA person now. We hired one person. We hired two people, are giving training to our executive team. And so if we're going to be spending money and we're going to be talking about diversity and inclusion and these kinds of things, I think people should listen to what students have to say and engage in some much more, I think, basic conversations.
Oh, it's so interesting. It does become, I guess, even calling it EDIA takes it from those, you know, the words equity, diversity, inclusion, accessibility. It sort of also becomes hidden as this sort of code acronym for an effort that's being made, I guess, that it is not necessarily tied to a result, I guess.
People assume that everybody knows what these words mean and how to define them, and as you say, how to like measure whether you're doing something good or not. Diversity and inclusion are like these wholesome words. Like, who would be against diversity? Who would be against inclusion? Nobody. But our schools don't even keep really good statistics about like who attends the school. You know, schools have been talking about these words in some cases for 30 and 40 years without even keeping really basic statistics about who's on campus. Sometimes I worry that these words and these programs are a smokescreen, and that there's like really simple, basic things you can do to help students, but that using this language and creating all of this bureaucracy is a way of avoiding actually doing some really simple, basic things that students are asking us to do.
In light of the attention in 2021 to the blog of Mount Allison professor Dr. Rima Azar, where she repeatedly denies that systemic racism exists in Canada, CHMA asked Cole about his work on systemic racism and what kind of response he has to those who deny that it exists.
I think the only way you can deny that systemic racism is real is if you don't know what it means, if you don't know what people are talking about when they say that. No one denies individual and interpersonal racism. which means like I walked up to somebody in the street and I called them a racial slur. We all know that that's racism. We all know it's wrong. And none of us deny that that does happen. When we're talking about systemic racism, we're talking about the fact that, for example, in the city that I live in, Black people make up about 10% of the population, but we are 20 times more likely, 20 times more likely than a white person to be shot and killed by the police. That's systemic racism. A country where only a fraction of people are Indigenous, but 60% of federal prisoners in Canada, in prisons, are Indigenous people. Like, that's systemic racism. All of the communities in Canada that don't have clean drinking water, the vast majority of them being Indigenous communities, that's systemic racism. We're talking about trends that are being mostly perpetuated by our institutions and by particularly government and other large institutions, like universities, for example. So sometimes I think people don't know what we're talking about. Maybe they think that we mean that everyone is racist, or maybe they think that systemic racism means that every single racialized person experiences bad outcomes in every single place that they go to. Everyone is racist against them. That's not what it means. People spend a lot of time fighting against this. I actually remember a couple of years ago, the head of the RCMP, Brenda Luckey, was asked a question by a reporter about systemic racism, and she said, there's no systemic racism in the RCMP, which is a hilarious thing to say for many reasons. Systemic racism doesn't pick and choose which institutions it's in. It's literally everywhere. And of course, Brenda Luckey came back a few days after saying that ridiculous comment and corrected herself. I try not to spend too much time fighting with people about whether or not it is real, because you just need to look around your own country and you need to listen to people who are experiencing racism so that you can understand it. In the same way that I would say that, like, you know, sexism and misogyny is not like a one workplace or one institution kind of thing. Misogyny and sexism against women and against gender nonconforming people is everywhere. It's part of society. And people spend a lot of time kind of resisting this idea. There's no point. There's no point. If you don't like it, then join together with us to destroy it. That's the point.
That was Desmond Cole speaking with Erica Butler. And to close the show, we turn the clock back to January 1988, when the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that Canada's criminal code provisions related to abortion violated Women's Charter guarantee of security of the person and were therefore unconstitutional. That decision prompted the decriminalization of abortion in Canada. Martha Painter, a New Brunswick nursing professor, says the decision was exceptional and important, and one that Canadians don't recognize enough. Painter is also the spokesperson for the newly founded New Brunswick Abortion Care Network, a group of 20 advocates working in the fields of nursing, obstetrics, family practice, pharmacy, and health administration. The network's mission is to compensate for the lack of information on abortion and to expand access to care. Painter says the conversation about abortion needs to change. Misinformation and lack of information is still a challenge.
Nova Scotia, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, most provinces and territories in Canada have between 1 and 3 sites for surgical services. The demand for surgical services has fallen year over year since the introduction of medication abortion in 2017. We really want patients to know everything that's out there. There are medication abortion prescribers all across the province in primary care, including nurse practitioners and family doctors. You know, medication abortion itself is still quite new, and some people don't know it exists or how it works. So that's information as well that we want to share and to normalize conversation about abortion. The number one issue is definitely misinformation and lack of information. New Brunswickers need to understand how abortion works. Aspiration abortion or surgical abortion is a very simple procedure. It takes about 7 minutes. Medication abortion includes 5 different pills, an intense experience, similar to a miscarriage, heavy cramping, heavy bleeding can last a couple of days. So it's not an instant fix. And we need to be more forthright and familiar with these very basic and essential parts of our reproductive health repertoire. And we've just had so many years of treating abortion like it was some secret special service. And it is normal, it is common, it is safe. And New Brunswickers should know about it and should know how to access it and know that both surgical abortion and medication abortion are available, publicly funded, if you have a health card. So in addition to the information gap that we need to fill, we're also really concerned about the equity issues. We're insisting that people have a Medicare card to get care. There are a lot of people without papers, and as care providers, we would never want to turn anyone away. So that is a policy issue that really is a serious priority for this province and every province to address. You know, 35 years ago, we became the only country in the entire world to have completely decriminalized care. And we remain the only country in the entire world with completely decriminalized care. Leadership globally, I don't think Canadians recognize just how exceptional and important that is to equity and to our democracy. And so as healthcare providers, we lean on Dr. Henry Morgenthaler's legacy. We want to carry on in his footsteps, always expanding access to care and keeping abortion in the news, in people's consciousness. So for us, the best way to honor him and that momentous Supreme Court decision is to come together to really have a public face to change the conversation about abortion.
That's all for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, Erica Butler, John Roon, and Megan Dooling, National Editor Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. At Viewpoints, we produce local news nationwide. Want to read and hear more? Go to canada-info.ca, canada-info.ca. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Thanks for keeping us company. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Until next week.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.